have been called on a few occasions in families where death had come, and most tragically. And it is to try to help you, to prepare you to minister under similar situations. Now, before I get into my regular discussion, there's a few things I want to say about this as far as sort of aging and death. Sometimes, on previous occasions, I sort of lumped this into aging and death and to discuss, well, how do we handle the aged? And we didn't really finish our discussion the other day, so I just want to make a few comments there. I mean, aging is a natural process, and a lot of people, I mean, you're sort of resistant, but it is. It's something you must face and learn to face it and prepare for it. It's a time that can be the most useful. A lot of people, as they get older, as the steps seem to get steeper and the distances longer, that this is really a time when they can, because many of the responsibilities are usually less, the children are grown, it's a time that should be a real fulfillment for utilization of their time to help others. And it's a real challenge to do this, to select carefully in those areas where you can do the most good. And also to remember those that are aged and to minister to them and visit them. We discussed how we handle our aging parents, for example. And I think it was a useful discussion. Now, we've had to redefine death. We have a physician in our midst today, and I don't think that it is accepted uniformly throughout the United States today relative to the new definition of death. Formerly, death was sort of defined as the cessation of respiration and heartbeat. And the physicians, well, in fact, there are two physicians here, and they can correct me and pitch in here. And I'm glad you're here, because we will get into a discussion on this, and it will be very useful. We're having to define it, redefine it, because let's just look at respiration and heart rate. I mean, I've worked on a lot of animals, and they may be still breathing, but the heart isn't beating, you know. Or the heart may be beating, but they quit breathing, you know. I mean, it isn't something that when one quits, the other quits right away. But if the heart quits beating for very long, or you quit breathing for very long, there are certain tissues, of course, that can't stand this very long. It is very important to remember. And some of your tissues, of course, will live a long time after you quit breathing and your heart stops breathing, it stops beating. But the sort of the thinking parts of your brain, they're probably good for only a few minutes without oxygen. I mean, 4 to 6 minutes is often given. There are other parts, maybe the centers for breathing and the heart rate, your brain stem, maybe it's good for 10 or 12 minutes. But that isn't very long, you know. And it isn't very long, much after that, before your adrenal probably and your kidneys sort of, you know, give out. And so this becomes very important today, because we are going in, and then the heart, of course, a little while later next. And so it becomes very important, you see, as we are thinking now of heart transplant and kidney transplant. We're not only thinking about them, of course, we've been doing them. And the success of the operation depends a great deal on just what is the state of that heart or kidney that's going to be transplanted. I'll give you an illustration of this. It happened in England. This fellow was gotten a brawl, and he was really beat up. He had very severe brain damage. He was brought in one night. It was about June the 15th. On June the 16th, they operated on him. His respiration ceased. They had to go to artificial respiration. And they went to the widow, or the widow-to-be, really, the next of kin, his wife, and said that he has stopped breathing. Can we get permission to transfer, to take a kidney for a kidney transplant to a person that's dying, and this is what he needs? Well, she gave permission to do this, although she understood that he was already dead, you see. Well, that was June 16th. And they did the operation then. They took out the kidney, and then they turned off the respirator on the 17th, huh? All right, now, what did he die from? Did he die because we turned off the respirator? Did he die because he got beat up by us down at the local pub? Or what, you know? And this becomes a very sticky legal problem. And then we're faced with an issue such as this. In Canada, just one example. This fellow was in a very serious auto accident. He had very severe brain damage. They got him into the emergency. They had to put in artificial respiration. They put in a tracheal tube on him and kept him on artificial respiration. And then they made a fistula to his stomach, through his abdomen, so they could feed him. 8 years, 8 months, and 19 days later, he died. Never coming and becoming conscious again. This is a tough problem, you know. It's a tough problem to face. When do you pull the tubes, you know? I mean, it's a very difficult problem. This is, and all the physicians have my sympathy. I mean, just, you know, just how far you would do you go. Pope Pius, who I didn't always agree with, but he had this to say in 1957 to a group of physicians. He reminded them that the use of artificial and extraordinary means in resuscitation of such patients is not morally required. Extraordinary in a theological sense means whatever here and now is very costly or very unusual or very painful or very difficult or very dangerous, or if the good effects that can be expected from its use are not proportionate to the difficulty and inconvenience that are entailed. This principle would solve many of the medical problems in these difficult cases, such as the one I just mentioned. I know for myself, I wish they'd pull the tubes when the time comes, you know? But it's a problem we're going to have to face, and it's a rough one. Now, what is the redefinition of death? Well, the French started this, and they have redefined it. And it's based on EEGs, electroencephalogram. Most of you have had EKGs, I suppose, to check your heart out. Electrical potentials are measured at various parts of the body. Well, they have EEGs, which are not quite as, they're not, it's still in some areas of black magic as to sort of the source of these, but there are certain patterns that are emitted when you put electrodes to measure the electrical potentials within the brain. It's manifested and detected from the outside. And you can tell, for example, sleep patterns and other things. They're good for diagnosis of certain conditions. Well, the French have essentially redefined death as the absence of any potentials. And this is what they're using, of course, as a basis for when do you take a transplant, you know. But it's very important that they get it soon. So I think with that redefinition, and I might say that many places in the United States they're using this too, because you can keep them going. You can keep the heart going for a long time. You can keep them respiring. You can put in artificial kidneys, huh? I mean, we got artificial almost everything, you know? So I think that's enough for that. Now, to get into the main thing, the death of death, I have subtitled this Incomprehensible But Not Absurd. A man asked a boy one day what he wanted to be when he grew up, and the boy thought for a while, and then he said, "I'd like to be alive." And as one, you know, sort of looks at the future, this might be wishing quite a bit as we look at a very troubled future. T.S. Eliot said that death is a stranger that we cannot deny. It has probably been widely stated that neither the sun nor death can be looked at steadily for very long. And a lot of people at this point will say, so why do you look at it, huh? And why do you, and you've been here and we've had a great time together for 17 days, and then the last day you talk about death. Now, I had something to say about death the other night, Monday night. And I hope some of you heard that, because it's how I feel about it. I will restate a few of these things. Well, my initial reply to the question of so why look at it is that if you haven't got anything to say about death, you don't have anything to say about life either. Others have said it better. Augustine in his Confessions pled for a keener awareness of death, not because he wished to dull the thirst for life, but for precisely the opposite reason, to intensify the self-awareness for life. Seneca said, no man enjoys the true taste of life but he who is willing and ready to quit it. Tragically today, the majority of people are probably like Rousseau, the central figure in Albert Camus' The Stranger, who said to the prison chaplain in about the only emotion he ever displayed, I have little time left, and I'm not going to waste it on God. Now, Americans often avoid discussions of death. Americans never die, they pass away. Max Lerner sums it up this way, whether through fear of the emotional depth or because of the drying up of the sluices of religious intensity, the Americans avoid dwelling on death or even coming to terms with it. He finds it morbid and recoils from it, surrounding it with words of avoidance and various taboos of speech and practice. A funeral parlor is decorated to look like a bank. Everything in a funeral ceremony is done in hushed tone, as if it were something furtive to be concealed from the world. There is so much emphasis on being dignified that the ceremony often loses its quality of dignity. In some of the primitive cultures, there is difficulty in understanding the cause of death. It seems puzzling and even unintelligible. Living in a scientific culture, Americans have a ready explanation of how it comes, yet they show little capacity to come to terms with the fact of death itself and with the grief that accompanies it. We jubilate over birth and dance at weddings, writes Margaret Mead, but more and more hustle the dead off the scene without ceremony, without the opportunity for young and old to realize that death is as much a fact of life as its birth. Our frantic accent on youth, our guilt and embarrassment about growing old are both reminders of our recoil from death. Yet there comes a time to all of us, as it must, the undeniable and inexorable here and now moment of dying. In spite of the ultimate statistic that one out of one dies, we continue to seek not only the true and the beautiful, but also the permanent. And I believe this is well expressed in the story of little Haller, the young Norwegian boy who I told you about on another occasion. A little Haller lived with his parents in Norway, and his grandmother was there too. And as in many cultures, the grandmother was probably his best friend. He saw the most of her, and he loved her very much. But as death must come to everyone, death came to Haller's grandmother, and he was overcome with grief. And following her death, of course, and to try to overcome some of the grief of his son, the father purchased a dog for the boy, and he became very fond of the dog, and the dog, of course, went with him everywhere. But as so often happens to dogs, this dog was run over by a truck. And of course, Halvor was overcome again with grief, and he just was sort of beside himself. So the father thought, well, I've heard that canaries live a long time, and that's at least it won't be run over by a car, So he got him a canary. And old Halvor thought, boy, this is really great. He was a beautiful singer. He'd get up in the morning, go down and give it water for bath and feed it. And this went on for quite a while. But then one morning, Halvor came down, and the canary was at the bottom of the cage, dead. He was overcome with grief, and he went to his father.
threw his arms around his leg, and he was really in a sob choked voice. He said, "Give me no go somewhere aldrig do. Give me something that will never die." But man's quest has been in vain. For our world is a world of death. And for all of us, like I said the other night, it's like the seventh game in the World Series. Someday, huh? Now, in scientific circles, we hear a lot about producing life in the laboratory. The concern of most people, however, is not how to produce life, but how to retain it. The death of death is man's greatest need, and also man's greatest hope. The Christian believes in the death of death. This belief is incomprehensible, but it is not absurd, and is devoutly desired. Death is defeated through death itself, and it is revealed to us only by God and accomplished through death itself, the death of the Son of God. Because of this, death is not the final end of life, as the ultimate statistic that's cited by G.B. Shaw when he said that one out of one dies. Death is not the final answer. Sin and death are defeated and have met their own end in a death, in a very special death. When Jesus said, "It is finished," that did it. Now, the ultimate statistic then is not one out of one dies, but one died for all. For it answers the most burning question posed by Job so long ago. When a man dies, will he live again? I think Dr. Oswald Hoffman summed it up very well when he stated, "If a man dies, will he live again?" is a real question asked by real men in a real world and receives its real answer from a real God who achieved a real victory over the grave, which all of us know to be real. I am here to tell you that life is real, and if death is real, then this really happened. One man came, was born, lived, and died, and ever since everything has been different. The facts are there for every intelligent man to see. Not only did Jesus Christ die, but he rose from the dead with a glory that people did not know he had. This man was God speaking to men and acting for men. Now, this is no illusion. The early Christians did not create these stories about the resurrection of Christ. It was the stories that created the Christian hope. Sustaining millions of people down through the centuries and carrying people along, even to today. It was not the love of his followers, but the power of God that raised Jesus Christ from the dead. Now, before my summary remarks now, I'm going to face this issue about examining the actual situation of the dying for a moment. And for this, I'm going to turn to something out of Omega. It's a newsletter that's concerned with time perspective and death and bereavement. And it's distributed through the Cushing Hospital in Framingham, Massachusetts. And in this, the Dr. Charles Ehring tells of a letter he received from his son, who was working as a clinical clerk in a hospital ward. And this young man describes his first poignant experience with the death of a patient. "I had my first patient die today, a very good man of 83 without anything at his bedside, anyone at his bedside, nurse or friend to help him. He was one of those unusual people whom you never forget. He came to our ward on Saturday morning and was put into the only empty bed of four. Beside him was a truck driver. Diagonally sat a proud, self-educated poet. Directly across lay a laborer. It was a room of four proud men. Occasionally, as best they could, the three would look to the newcomer's needs, but he appreciated far more their company. For he would listen to them, though he did not enter into the flow of talk. He was the sick one, they knew. And they would ask quietly about him during our less urgent ministrations to them. And when the old man's condition worsened, he was moved by the nurses to a single room, where the frequent visits of doctors to his bedside would not awaken the other patients. Of course, they were not asked. They are never party to these arrangements. He immediately asked me to return to his old room. Most important to him was the comfort he derived from being with people. I promised this would be done as soon as he was seen by the surgeon. And when I drew blood for tests, he again quietly asked if he could return to his old room. And again I assured him that he would soon be returned. Mid-afternoon Monday, x-rays were taken. He was becoming short of breath, and I propped him up against the pillow. The nurses were about to give him intravenous medication. He had become more short of breath, but found some relief when I elevated the head of his bed. A last time, he asked if he would be able to find a place for him in his old room. I told him he would have to wait a little longer, but thought only I could do to help him and bring him there now. But the surgeon had not yet seen him. And later, as I passed by his door, I saw that he'd slipped down in the bed. I went in and reached over the bed rail to help him up onto the pillows, but there was no need of it. He had died alone, denied what he most wanted, the unspoken comfort of people, any people around him. Dr. Ehring then comments on his son's letters. As I cogitated, this report moved in proud of the principal characters. I thought the patient died with what dignity he could muster and with my son's respect and with his humanity. His want of his friends and familiar surroundings, new though they were, should have been an imperative and taken precedence over any and all technical matters. My guess is that had the other three patients been consulted, they would have wanted it too. How slavish has become our worship of the great God Routine. The human, and most especially the humane, are counted for less than the machine. I am reminded of A.E. Housman's, "I see in many an eye that measures me the mortal sickness of a mind too unhappy to be kind." The artist gives way to the technician in an age of scientism. One of my own regrets is that I could not be with my father when he died a year ago, this last January. And I say that to you so that I happen to be on the East Coast and he was on the West Coast. And I think this is a regret that I will take probably for the rest of my life. And I'm saying it to you so that that you try to make the opportunity that you will be with your loved ones when they die, because they need this comfort at life's dramatic moment. We as Christians must help lend both kindness and dignity to what is life's most dramatic moment. Dr. Saunders, a nurse and social worker, states it well when she wrote, "The last stages of life should not be seen as defeat, but rather as life's fulfillment. It is not merely a time of negation, but rather an opportunity for positive achievement. One of the ways we can help our patients most is to learn to believe and expect this." Now, there's a few sort of do's and don'ts here. This is from a Dr. Racy in Beirut, Lebanon. And he says, "Don't tell old parents that their child is doomed. I have seen them lose their minds." Number two, don't read about the disease from a textbook, neither to patients nor to relatives. Three, and this is the most important one, don't cut off hope in God's healing powers. And I know myself, I'm not a physician, but I've seen quite a few people, and I've also, of course, observed many, many animals. And it's really hard to predict the ones that are going to die and when. I mean, some of them, yes, but a lot of them, no. Huh? Keep the light of hope alive in case of acute illness, because no matter how grave the situation may appear, it may be reversible. One very intelligent young woman who suffered for years from an incurable disease, one day during one of the visits to the doctor, he told her that after all, medicine had its limitations. And her response was this, "Doctor, we are good friends. Don't tell any of your other patients what you told me today. Patients are not interested in your limitations. Patients expect hope and courage from you." And then another thing, maintain a dignified attitude in the presence of the dying and the dead. And another one, a very important one, speak reassuring words even to the comatose one, for often the message does register and may well be recalled on awakening. And there are some very sad things in the literature on this. I mean, in cases where the person who is dying is comatose, and the people are sitting around the room talking and wondering how they're going to divide the estate. Huh? And this has happened, really. And then the person wakes up and has registered, essentially, all of this. And I know in one case it essentially drove the person mad. What you do, even if the person is comatose, you give them reassuring words. And I wish Carol was here, and he'd give you a very good example of this within his own family. And I told you the other night about, I read you the poem, He Was Only 24, which is one of the great eulogies, one of the greatest eulogies ever written. And it was Dr. Rognes, and he lost one of his sons very tragically. A son was probably one of the greatest potentials of probably anyone or most people knew. And he died at 24. And here was a son of the president of one of our seminaries, you see. And this was a real test, you know. And a lot of people ask, well, how did he take it, you know? How did he take it? Hmm? Well, I'll tell you what Carol told him. I probably can't say it like he said it. But he said he wept. He grieved, huh? Because a Christian loves much, he grieves much. Huh? He cried. He wept. Huh? That's how he took it. And that's how we ought to take it. I mean, a lot of us, I mean, and when I was a lot younger, I hesitated to cry. When you get older, you don't care so much. You show your emotions probably more. But you do weep, huh? Weep with them who weep. Don't be afraid of it. It's kind of a cleansing thing. So you take it like a man. You weep. Huh? Everywhere one goes, he finds the gaping grave swallowing up the dying. Tears of loss, of separation, of final departure, stain on every face. Every table, sooner or later, will have an empty chair. Every side and vacant place. Death is a great leveler. We can only beat our fists in utter futility against the unyielding and unresponding tomb. Unless you believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, which has made all the difference in the world. In Christ, the risen and living Lord, you can have peace. The climax of the whole story is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. After that, anything could happen. After that, everything did happen. A new age was born, a new faith came into being, a new spirit entered the world. So what do we do about it? We must do something about it. We tell others of the death of death, and we live in the assurance of the fact, and it is our place to minister to the bereaved and to the dying, and to face it alike men. And how should we face death? We face it triumphantly, knowing that we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the skies, and with the realization that the sufferings of the present time are nothing to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed. And my prayer is that we may be like Simeon, who could say, now let thy servant depart in peace, for mine eyes have seen thy salvation. And we face death with the courage to emulate Polycarp, who was the bishop of Smyrna, who was probably instructed, if he probably met the apostle John, and was instructed by one of John's pupils. He had had a wonderful life serving his Lord, and at about the age of over 80, during the persecution of the Christians. He was finally arrested, and they tried to make him renounce his Lord. And because many people loved him, they recognized him for what he was, a very human person and a man of God. And they wanted to save his life, and they say, well, just renounce your Lord. And he said, I cannot renounce my Lord, who has watched me all these 84 years or whatever it was. And so they, of course, did what they did to Christians at that time. They burned him at the stake. He asked that he not be tied to the post, as most of them were. And as they lit the fire around him, he looked heavenward and he said, I thank thee, Lord, that thou hast found me worthy of this day and hour. And that's courage in the face of death. And that concludes what I want to say to you this morning about death. Are there any is there some discussion?
I find it so very hard to accept today. There are the doctors who over. It seems to me that people aren't really allowed to die in many instances today. Like you said, I feel the same way when I kind of come full of you, because it seems there are so many patients when the doctors have even committed themselves to the fact that there's nothing else they can do for them, they're continuing. And what really bothers me is the financial part of the family and the brain too. I mean, not only financial, but in every way. It seems to me, if it would be a doctor's responsibility to do that,
you have stated that we must not give up hope. We must not, the patient would ask us not to discourage hope. And there is this matter of human professional pride that you start a procedure while you feel the patient may still live and you don't know when to stop. You know that when you feel that losing faith if you stop what you once told the family would help. Coming back to your case of the man who lived over 8 years, or rather who breathed and had a pulsating heart over 8 years, but it's for the theologian, or the theologian in each of us, to say, did he die 8 years before? We often speak of certain persons, certain people in that case as being vegetables, the term.
Yes.
And that's what you mean when you say you wish to pull. That our physiologists have shown that the animal can live with the top of the brainstem cut off, that is, the breathing and respiration can be maintained, but we have, for each of us, we have to decide where the seat of the soul is. It was mentioned last night that in the matter of the shell being here. And I think a physician will agree very much with the expense side of it. I don't believe that a family should be ruined by futile attempts when you know that those 10 minutes without oxygen or 4 minutes without oxygen have gone by, and that what you are saving is not your loved parents or son or daughter or mother. It is a real problem for all of us.
course, in California, we have even a more complicated situation because, he may well be sued for $250,000, you see, maybe for pulling the tubes, you see. I mean, there's some ridiculous suits, you know.
Can a wife or the nearest family make the decision to pull a tube? Or are doctors down legally?
Well, yeah, I'd like to have you address that.
I very definitely, when I'm thinking down people, tell them that I want to know their attitude toward that. I want to know whether they want me to keep them alive with the tubes, or if I think they have reached the place that is past the point of any return, if they want me to tell the family that from this point on I will keep them comfortable. I'll keep them free of pain and try to keep them free of bed sores, but I'll do nothing for so long life. I won't give intravenous, I won't give oxygen. But they have to have told some other member of their family that this is their decision, not my decision. And their son or daughter or mother, somebody has to say, this patient told me that you had agreed not to keep them alive. Once in a while, we have to call the surgeon in who counteracts our order. I had this happen fairly recently when a woman was dying of a massive hemorrhage, and a surgeon on the case ordered 4 units of blood for a transfusion when the patient was essentially dead and demanded that they be given. I counteracted the order. He rewrote the order. The transfusions were given, and the patient died at the time of the last transfusion. And the patient was saying to me, why did you break your word?
I wish there were more doctors like
you. Yeah, I was going to say that...
Did you die?
Yeah, if I'm in Spokane, and when I'm dying, I hope my family calls you. Because I have already, of course, told my family, I mean, my wishes on this. My wife and I have discussed this, the chief and I, and we're agreed on this, and we've also told our children, and I think my son appreciates it, who will probably be making the decision, and he'll be going into medicine this fall, and he's pretty realistic.
You baffle me on one thing you say.
Yes.
You say you must not let the patient give up hope.
I was quoting somebody else.
You're saying you must be realistic with them or you implied it.
Yeah.
Do you believe that a dying man must be allowed to know he's dying so he can make last changes?
Yeah. I should have qualified that, yes. I'm not necessarily in agreement with this person I quoted. I'm telling you how some people feel about it. And there, I think you have to evaluate the patient, and I'm sure you do. I mean, I had a very dear friend of mine at the age of 37, really go down the tubes with carcinoma of the alimentary tract. He'd been an associate for a long time. And he was really just reaching his scientific potential. I mean, he was really gone. And he just showed up with it in November, December, and he was gone by May. Hmm? Now, this person, throughout his life, was very much afraid of death. Huh? And this was a really, it really had him, you know? And he just did everything to prolong his life. I mean, everything, he evaluated everything on its health merits. His physician and the surgeon knew this too, and in this case they felt that, at least initially, that this would have been such psychological trauma for him that he couldn't take it. I mean, he would have gone off his rocker. At least this was their decision. I talked it over with him, and I said, well, I mean, I had some misgivings about it. But in this case, I mean, and they may well have been right. In my case, and I've talked over with other physicians on this, where, I mean, they try to, maybe not really abruptly, but say, well, I mean, this is how it is, you know, because this, you have to face this on a cancer thing, you know. I mean, and boy, so many times, huh? So many times. I'll never forget, and this is how you never know when these situations will face you. In our professional students, we have about 85 students. And I gave a few lectures in this class, and I was stopped by one girl in the class. It was a very bright young girl named Donna, in the hallway, and she says, my field is radiation biology, and she was very concerned about her father, because he had had a cancer, I think, of the esophagus. And the way she described it, I mean, it sounded pretty grim, you know. And they'd given him all the radiation therapy that he could stand, you know. And he was having pains and so forth. And of course, there was still hope in here. I mean, she was still cherishing hope. But it was a situation where, boy, you could just see, you know, this fellow had just a few months to go. But she wasn't really facing up to it, you know. In a kind of way, it's like, oh, I mean, there she was. I mean, I was standing in the hallway, students going by and forth, and she was crying, of course. This was a real privilege, I think, on my part, that I was able, I went home and I wrote her a very long letter. And I also gave her a book to read. I'm a C.S. Lewis. Incidentally, this can often be a very great help. He has written a book. He wrote it under Envy Clerk, called A Grief Observed. It's now under C.S. Lewis's name, because after his death, they put his real name on it. He wrote it at the time when his wife was, just after his wife died. He went through this very intense grief. He married her. Late in life, he married Joy Davidman. Some of you know Joy Davidman because of her book, Smoke on the Mountain. But she married him when she was an incurable cancer patient, but there appeared to be some hope of remission. In fact, there seemed to be, I mean, she was up walking in the garden with him, you know, and it really looked hopeful, you know. And then he wrote this book. Well, I was able to help this girl in a sort of a simple, in my own simple way, when these opportunities will come to you. But here was a case where they weren't facing up to it. And I think that's the healthy way to do it. But there may be an exceptional case where, and I'm glad you raised the point, because I believe in facing up to it. But there are some that it may drive them mad. I don't know. But maybe, if properly handled, it would. Do you want to say any more to that, or did you want to say any more to that? Yes?
Will the person ever try to die?
Oh, yes. I don't know. I'm from Richland, Washington. And Dr. Lee, for example, who's a surgeon there, Bjorn Lee, I mean, he tells his patient, he says, all right, you have cancer, huh? You have cancer, we're going to do all we can for you. I mean, I cannot make a firm prediction on this, but you must know this, and we're going to do all we can in our power to try to cure this situation. But you must realize that cures aren't 100%, huh? So you have to face this.
My mother had And this is some years ago now, over 20, and her doctor said, "We never tell a patient." And I lived through this, and she and I were keeping on this little play with one, but she knows she was keeping it from me, that I know, I've never gotten over.
This happened to me, that my mother died of cancer, and the doctor refused to let me cry. I was just a first-year medical student, and I was a cross-doctor. And the last words my mother spoke, you at least could have told me the truth.
And that's pretty damning, you know.
This was one of the reasons that we always or always do tell the patient, but generally, it's very simple to say, our skills aren't as great as there are other skills. And it's up to you now to do what has to be done. And before we do an operation or something of the sort, we will say to patients, do you want to be told? Do you want to read the surgeon's report? Do you want to read the pathologist's report?
Very good point.
Do you want me to explain it to you, or do you not want me to? I'll play it the way you want it. And there are many people who really, as you say, don't want to know. There are others that do, and they'll never use the word again. I have one patient who has metastatic carcinoma. Her daughter came from California to see her just this last week. I said, your mother knows? She said, yes, but she calls it that pain is under control. Each individual has to be.
Can everybody hear this? These are very important points that are being made. No, were you able to hear? I'll repeat some of it if you can. Yeah, they're human too, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a meeting one time last year in a county medical society.
Can you all hear this?
And this sort of a meeting should have been for the general public, but we invited all of the ministers and priests in our town. And we had a doctor from Chicago. We had a Episcopalian priest from Victoria. And we had a lawyer from Seattle, and they talked just about the subject. And the priest let the lawyer explain all the legal ramifications. The doctor explained that, in his opinion, the patient should be allowed the choice. And the minister got up and sort of smiled at everybody, and he said, if I were talking in a Christian era instead of in a post-Christian era, I would say this discussion is entirely futile. Every Christian knows that an extra day, an extra month, or an extra year doesn't mean anything.
Yes?
So that sort of brings up a question I was thinking of. In whether there can be a hastening, an intentional hastening of death, when a patient is conscious, not just taking method means to prevent him from dying.
It's not a bad man that he had a certain disease instead of truthfully telling him that he has cancer. And he is in a ward where there are lots of other people. And he sees people come in with this disease that he's told that he has instead of cancer. And they get operated on, or they get taken care of, but he's told he has an ulcerated stomach instead of a cancerous stomach. And they have surgery and they get well and they leave. And somebody else has medical routine and they get well and they leave. And he stays and gets worse and hemorrhages and can't eat. He loses faith in his doctor. He loses faith in himself. He loses faith in his God. It's much worse to lie to a thinking person.
Oh yeah, that's not my question. My question is whether we might have the choice to encourage that, rather than to
hasten the end rather than prolong it.
Yeah, and it's not a matter of acting to prolong it, but acting to hasten it, you know, not hastening it by just leaving things alone, but actually doing particular things to hasten it. I mean, that could be called murder, I guess, you know,